You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Josh.
How are you, Bob? Great to be back with you.
It's great to have you. And as long as you ask, I actually have a cold and I just finished shoveling snow. So, uncharacteristically, I may let the guests do much of the talking this time because I'm tired and ill, Josh. So we're counting on you.
All right.
You feeling vibrant?
I am. I'm smacked in with snow. I'm in Boston at a friend's house. I'm supposed to be going to Utah, but I'm here. It's a good place to be caught. Boston is always charming, especially under a foot of snow.
Yep. It's a great city. And you're a great person to have right now because it's a good week to talk about the Middle East. And you are a scholar of the Middle East. You are, for one thing, a fellow at the Quincy Institute, but you're also at Oklahoma University, where your titles are what exactly?
Co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies, the Sandra Mackey Chair of Middle East Studies in the College of International Studies. Now you have every title I can possibly evoke.
Plus guest on my podcast. I hope that's on your resume.
That is at the top.
Good. So big headline this week, so far as the Middle East goes, is that the administration is signaling that if the negotiations with Iran are not successful this Thursday, the United States may strike Iran at any time. They have assembled a huge amount. I mean, the U.S. has a huge amount of military hardware in the vicinity. And they're talking about very big aspirations like regime change. There are various scenarios. But it's a little puzzling to me because it seems like this whole thing started out being about Iran having killed protesters. And yet the negotiations are about the nuclear program, which Trump said he had, you know, disabled for a very long time with the June bombing, which was done in concert with Israel, of course. So I'm a little puzzled by what exactly the strategic logic is behind this. Do you have a sense for what the administration is thinking?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's good to put it back in the context of Israel's attack on the axis of resistance, if you will, that began with a campaign against Hezbollah, decimated Hezbollah. Then rather, I think Israel was rather surprised when the regime, Assad's regime, just collapsed after that. Just the littlest push by the opposition caused the military to run away, and none of its traditional supporters, whether that was Iran or Hezbollah or Ahl al-Haq in Iraq or the Russians, really could do anything. And his army, which was starved, and the country, which was just hanging by a thread economically, really just folded in on itself. And then Israel was left in this position where it had destroyed many of the elements that were part of this axis of resistance. And then it convinced the United States and President Trump to join it in this 12-day war, in which they pounded the nuclear facilities and defense elements of the Iranian regime. But they didn't destroy the Iranian regime. And I think many, you know, Michael Oren, ambassador, Israeli ambassador to the United States for many years, author, and oddly a classmate of mine at Princeton, a graduate classmate, wrote an article just the other day saying, this is Israel's chance. You know, we have succeeded in destroying many of our enemies, but in order to consolidate our real strategic gains, we need regime change in Iran. We've got to take down this Islamic Republic. And if we miss this opportunity, it'll really be a real missed opportunity. And so I think behind much of the thinking in Washington is this sense that Iran is hanging by a thread. America should go in there and clip that thread and carry out regime change. And I think from a Trumpian point of view, this makes sense. You know, the world is his oyster, And there are enemies like Venezuela or Cuba or Iran. And he can, when he sees an opportunity, he should just take them down. And why not?
But none of those are, but none of those are enemies in the sense of actual national security threats to the United States, right?
Right. This is not national security.
So you mean it makes sense for Trump politically, not necessarily for the U.S. kind of geostrategically?
Yes, I would argue that this does not make sense geostrategically. I mean, trying to meddle with Iran has many potential downsides, not only for the region, but for the United States particularly. But that's not always, you know, this is about taking away, well, if you look at it as taking out enemies, right? Uh-huh. Getting exacting, you know, just clearing the way, which is something that President Trump does to his enemies. And I think it's a sort of way of looking at the world. It makes sense in that light. But you're right. If we look at it as America's interests, Iran does not really threaten America's interests. And the Middle East today is very divided over America's policy towards Iran. Some of our closest allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Egypt, so forth, are asking us not to do this. They, you know, Pakistan and so forth, they're worried because if Iran explodes into civil war, if we were to really carry out, decapitate the regime, and it explodes into civil war, as so many countries have done previously, whether it's Libya or Syria or Iraq, Afghanistan, when you decapitate the state and you leave society, often a very divided society, that don't have leadership, they fall into civil war. And that could cause, you know, Iran is a country of 90 million people. It's not Iraq, which was 24 in 2003 million, or Syria, which was 22 million people, or Libya, which was 7 or 8 million people. This would be on a whole different scale. The refugees flowing out could be quite substantial, and it would disrupt the region. So Saudi Arabia, Turkey, our allies don't want this. Israel does, because it's far away, and it would finish off this set of enemies.
It's not, when you say it's far away, it's not far away from Israel geographically, or at least not as far away from
us. It's within missile shot. You're right. But the refugees aren't going to end up in Israel.
I see.
The destabilized region isn't going to necessarily hurt Israel.
But traditionally, American presidents have not liked instability, right? Now, I gather Israel almost literally does, in the sense that I gather Israel's goal is to make sure that none of the surrounding nations that have traditionally been enemies or adversaries have much power. And so, for example, you mentioned Syria. When the regime change happened in Syria a little more than a year ago, all signs were that the new regime could be open to a friendly relationship with Israel. But Israel, rather than gamble, launched a bombing campaign, just took out a lot of military hardware, and they have tried to keep the regime from entirely consolidating power within Syria's borders. And when I say to people about the prospect of regime change in Iran, bombing them into regime collapse, you know, when I say, as many people say, be careful what you wish for, it's far from clear that you'd get some kind of orderly succession and wind up with a friendly regime. What people say to me is, you have to understand, like, Israel is fine with collapse and civil war. Like, that's a win from their point of view. Now, I'm curious, is that actually true from your point of view? I mean, that is the way they look at it. But B, why is that in America's point of view, in America's interest?
Well, I don't think it is in America's interest. And, General Dan Kane, who's chief, you know, he is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, just is quoted in the Washington Post and Axios today saying, we better be very careful, because this is dangerous, and it's the downsides are many. And he's warning against it. And I think many other in Washington have also sounded that alarm, because clear.
Did you say he's a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs?
No, he is the Joint Chiefs.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd pay attention to that if I were the president.
Well, yes, you would.
That's why I'm not president, I guess.
But, you know, George W. Bush, when Shinseki warned against going into Iraq, he was summarily fired because there were many others who wanted to go ahead with the operation, as foolhardy as it was. And so it's not always the voice of reason that wins out in these things.
And in fact, when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, I think that's what he was, said to, you know, let it be known during the Biden administration that he, that after some big Ukrainian successes on the battlefield, it was time to try to get a peace deal. The Biden administration didn't seem to pursue that. So, yeah, the president's in charge. So do you have, well, let's, I mean, there are two things I'm interested in. There are several, but one is how this might play out militarily, and the other, relatedly, is what might ensue in the wake of a regime collapse. Why don't we start with the first, and why don't we start with the politics of it? Like, what do you think Trump is really thinking? It seems safe to say he does not want to put boots on the ground in any enduring way, and it seems to me he's naive if he thinks that some kind of quick special ops operation of the kind that worked in Venezuela is going to work here. So I'm imagining a pure kind of bombing campaign. They have signaled that maybe what they do is like some quick sharp strikes and then pause and say, now do you want to do the deal we have in mind? And then if that fails, a more thorough bombing campaign. But what do you have any sense for what, of course, Trump himself is a, you know, he's been on to change his mind, but do you have a sense for what the administration has in mind over the next week or two, how to play this out?
You know, that's what's missing here, I think, is a real plan on how to move forward. President Trump, the last time the U.S. struck Iran, it worked out pretty well for the United States. President Trump could say that he had joined our ally Israel, that he had struck a blow against a nasty regime, and that he had totally destroyed their nuclear facilities. Now, he needs to go a step further, which is the problem, because if you just hit them again, you haven't changed the status quo. And we've got the further complicating factor that there were these big demonstrations that were so brutally put down in Iran. And he said, help is on its way. And I think that to a certain extent, he feels like he needs to act on that, that many Iranians have kept up the steady drumbeat of you need to perform. So by moving this armada there in the hopes that it would spark negotiation and a real step down on the part of the mullahs in Iran. Mm-hmm. And I think people in his administration, some in his administration, are rather surprised that it hasn't had this effect on Khomeini. That is, he's not, in a sense, shaking in his boots and deciding, okay, we're going to give up our nuclear facilities and we're going to make some deep compromises. I think that surprised people in Washington. And now they're scratching their head on how to move forward, that they have to carry out what some people thought was a bluff, but it's no longer a bluff.
Right. Now, Iran is willing to, in effect, provide reassurance that it's not producing nuclear weapons, right? And another return to something like the original deal where they're doing low-level enrichment for civilian purposes. And I think they've offered to suspend enrichment entirely for several years. And then when they resume, it would involve these other countries. And so I guess there'd be more assurance than ever that it wasn't a weapon. But for some reason, like, ending the enrichment program altogether so far is a red line for them. I mean, we'll see. Negotiations aren't over. But is that your understanding of it?
Yes, it is. You know, the red line, Khomeini and his people have, IRGC, have invested so much over the decades in putting forward this notion that they have the right to this, to refine and to nuclear power, that this is every country has the right to nuclear power. They will negotiate on a weapon and oversight and so forth, but they're not going to negotiate on the right to refine and to have nuclear power and to to have scientists and the whole nine yards of being an advanced country. So that's what they're not willing to sacrifice on. And I think that they've come to the calculation that if they do sacrifice on it, that's only going to whet the Trump administration's appetite for more sacrifices, that immediately they'll see blood in the water and Washington will want to go in for many more. And, you know, the next series of demands that were originally on the table by Washington was no more missile capability. And you've got to give up your missile manufacturing, which is the centerpiece of Iran's self-defense.
Now, I suspect one reason Trump may not feel like making further compromise is that, of course, Bibi Netanyahu would like the conventional missiles to be part of the current deal. And in fact, my sense is Bibi came over here not long ago and Trump kind of rebuffed him. Of course, you know, Bibi always wants a lot, but he wanted some inclusion of conventional missiles. I gather Trump said no. So I assume Trump is thinking like, wait a second, you know, he's done Iran a favor. Rebuffing Israel isn't always done by American presidents. Is it your sense that first of all, that happened? And if it happened, do you agree that that may make Trump feel he's gone almost as far as he can go?
Yes. You know, I think if we make a comparison to Gaza, if we can, in a sense, what Trump has done in Gaza is he has internationalized Gaza. You know, this new board of peace, in a way, you know, many presidents have always insisted that Gaza and the Palestinian question should be resolved between Israel and the warring states. Now, most of the Arab states have made peace with Israel, and so it's really the Palestinians against Israel, which, of course, creates a balance of power that is completely unequal. The Palestinians always wanted it to be internationalized and have the UN sitting at the table, international law, which would help weigh in their favor. Mm-hmm. Now, Americans always resisted that. And here's Trump, who has, in a sense, taken the issue away from Israel, or struggling with Israel to take it away. And he's created this international board, and he's made himself the head of it, not Netanyahu. So in a way, he has taken the issue, or he's prying it out of Netanyahu's hands. Of course, Netanyahu has not given it up. And he said, we're the only ones who are going to have any real deciding power over what gets into Israel, what gets into Gaza, as well as when we're going to stop bombing Hamas, because we want to see it completely destroyed. So those authority lines are not decided. But there is, in a sense, a tug of war going on between Trump and Netanyahu. And I think that analogy, although it's not 100% workable in the Iran situation, President Trump is, I think he's acutely aware that he does not want to be seen as the lapdog of Netanyahu. But he does want to be seen as taking charge of this issue and of working to bring down this regime, and helping the Iranian people, quote unquote, answering this call to destroy the nuclear power and to somehow help the demonstrators. This, you know, he would like the Nobel Prize of Peace and to move ahead with this. Now,
traditionally, launching major wars hasn't been the path to the Nobel Peace Prize, has it?
But, well, I think he's not going to launch a major war. He's looking for a way to do this rather painlessly. And the way, you know, the same Venezuela model. The trouble is he's already done the Venezuela, and the Iranians are acutely aware that he's going to be looking to decapitate the regime, and they must all be hiding in bunkers and changing beds every night, I would imagine. They're not going to fall victim. They've done this. They've been there. And in the last time around, many of their leading defense officials were assassinated. So I'm sure the lesson has been absorbed.
Yeah, Israel assassinated something like 30 generals, I think, during the June war. And it clearly, in retrospect, had tremendous intelligence penetration of Iran. Now, so I assume that Iran, in reaction, has done a certain amount of purging and preparation for a second attempt at this. So, yeah, it seems to me, just the common sense that the Iranian regime has worked hard to be resilient in the face of something like that. And remember, they did survive. I mean, the regime survived the first time, even though I think they were taken by surprise by how much Israel had penetrated the country. But so now I did hear one scenario according to which the regime is in deep trouble. It was a Twitter thread by somebody I hadn't heard of, but is followed by a lot of people like you, maybe by you, but a lot of people I respect in foreign relations. And the argument was that last time around in June, Iran had a lot of ballistic missiles that were not within the range of Israel or the United States. And there's something about the forces that are being arrayed by the United States this time that makes that much less true. As I recall, the scenario was that a lot of these ballistic missiles, and maybe non-ballistic, I'm not sure, but conventional missiles are kind of kept underground or somewhere secure, but there are these entryways that if you bomb them, they can't bring them out. And the idea was that I think a lot of them are in parts of the country that are pretty remote, but that this time around, the U.S. has amassed force in a way that will make them a lot more vulnerable. I mean, maybe that's a long-winded way of asking you, do you have any sense for the likely retaliatory capacity of Iran and the inclination to use it?
Well, you know, the Iranians did say that they would shoot down American aircraft carriers. Now, whether they're how capable they are of doing that, I'm not really able to say. And how capable the United States is to intercept their missiles. We do know that they have missiles because Hezbollah shot down an Israeli ship in 2006 with missiles that came from Iran. That surprised everybody. But that's, you know, the Americans are clearly aware of all of this and they've studied the possibilities. So the next thing is closing the Straits of Hormuz and not letting oil out and trying to drive the oil price up, or attacking Saudi Arabia and America's allies in the Gulf, whether it's Qatar or Saudi Arabia. They're clearly quite vulnerable, and that's why they've been asking the United States not to do this. Mm-hmm. But that's a very high price for Iran to pay, because Iran and Saudi Arabia and Qatar have been improving their relations, and particularly Iran and Saudi Arabia Saudi Arabia has gone way out of its way, not only to return ambassadors, but to urge Washington not to do this. And it's been signaling Iran that Saudi Arabia is much more valuable as an ally, or at least an advocate in Washington, than it is, you know, that it shouldn't be alienated, because you pull Iran's tail and you pull Saudi Arabia's tail and it might turn around and reverse its ideas about stability in Iran. So there's not a lot of good choices for Iran. And I think that emboldens many of the people who are saying, let's finish it off. But it's a big neighborhood, and Iran does have this far-reaching capability. And we saw that in the last war, it hurt Israel a little worse than many people thought it could, despite American efforts to shoot down all those missiles and so forth. So it leaves a question mark. Clearly, Iran has overplayed its hand. It turned out to be more of a paper tiger than anybody thought, and that gives people the courage to move ahead. But at the same time, it did hurt Israel, and it does have all these missiles, and you never know what surprise could be in store.
Yeah, I especially when the regime may see its very survival as at stake. I mean, you know, it's always been pretty restrained when you think that, you know, these are entirely unprovoked attacks that it's responded in a token way to. I'm thinking about the Soleimani assassination and the June war. And in both cases, it is signaled to the United States, we're going to do this token thing, get your soldiers out of the way so you don't get anybody killed, right? But when the very survival of the regime seems to be at stake, and I would think the political situation in Iran makes that something the regime thinks about, all the more so when Trump has basically said we'd like regime change and has assembled a huge force. It just seems to me that you could well see a much more thoroughgoing attack on American forces, including ships. And, you know, once some Americans have died, it's going to be hard for Trump to back down, right? I would guess, who knows? He's unpredictable,
Which is exactly the reason why I think Iran is more likely to be restrained. You know, we've seen, these are not the crazy mullahs that often people say, well, they're just crazy mullahs and they can't have nuclear weapons and stuff and we should take them out. But their restraint in the past incidences of not escalating seems to come from a view that they're playing rope-a-dope with a much more powerful opponent, and they do not want to provoke the bear. You know, they'll provoke them up to a certain point, but they don't want to get into an escalatory thing because they're going to lose. Mm-hmm. And so they're taking it across, you know, they're taking their punches and they sit there, they look vulnerable, but the fact that they don't collapse, that they're able to come out the other end and then begin to rebuild, clearly has frustrated these foreign powers, both Israel and the United States, who are looking for regime change, poking around and waiting for a vulnerability. And I think if Iran escalates and begins to attack Saudi Arabia and others, it could get itself into a world of trouble because it would turn the entire region against Iran. And it could, you know, that once anger gets into the picture and clouds people's more deliberative skills, it would be bad quickly for Iran.
Now, I'd be surprised if they hit Saudi Arabia. I mean, the Saudis have said they're not going to let the U.S. use their airspace in this attack, right?
Right. They've done everything correctly to signal to Iran, you should not hit us. We're not part of the problem. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they're the weak link in this Western coalition. And if you're trying to hurt people, if you're trying to send the West a message, in some ways it makes sense to attack Saudi Arabia, because then you're hurting a Western ally and you're showing the Western ally, America's stupid and they can't defend you and they're doing things that are going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. And that's one potential strategy. It has high risks, though, as you've pointed out.
But would they be hitting American facilities in Saudi Arabia or actually hitting? I mean, back when they were on worse terms with Saudi Arabia, they actually hit oil facilities, and that did send a message.
You know, uptake, they took out a Saudi refining, you know, the 50% of Saudi refining capacity. They've hit Kuwait. No, they were hitting these vulnerable spots. The Americans are less vulnerable. They're going to try to attack American bases, I would think. And we're seeing the Americans rather precipitously pulling out of Syria, which are very vulnerable bases. And their exposure in Iraq has been much reduced. So the United States, I think, is positioning itself to really diminish its vulnerabilities in the region for this reason. But still, there are many vulnerabilities because it has bases sprinkled throughout the Persian Gulf region.
Yeah. No, I would think disrupting the oil shipments is a relatively appealing option to Iran. I don't know, right?
Yes, because it affects the entire world and it affects the economy in a way that Trump is vulnerable. That's the one thing he cares about, and he understands that midterm elections are connected to the economy. And if you create inflation, you jack up oil prices. The question is, how long can Iran jack up oil prices? You know, there might be a spike for a week or two, and we saw this in the last confrontation. Oil prices went up for only a day, and then they collapsed again.
Yeah, I think if I'm Iran, I mean, not that I am, but I might. I would send a couple of missiles in the direction of U.S. ships, assuming probably not going to hit them. But it sends a message that if this goes on too long, Trump could wind up with some dead service people, and disrupt the shipping, disrupting it until Trump stops and says, why don't we talk some more? What's that?
Yes. I mean, there's the Houthis and so forth. But of course, sustaining that over a period of time is difficult. Yeah. And that's where the arm wrestling is going to go on. undoubtedly.
Yeah, the final thing that worries me about the huge amassing of military hardware is it seems to me, I guess you already said this, but it makes it harder for Trump to settle for any kind of pinprick. I mean, first of all, I thought you already did that in June, right? Like you hit the nuclear facilities, you said they're out of commission. Now you've got a ton of force in the arena. We're expecting something big, like regime collapse. It seems that makes it harder for him to settle for something short of that. And now, do you have a theory as to if what does come in the wake, if there is a collapsed regime, what comes in the wake? I mean, some people would like to see the son of the Shah of Iran, who was, of course, deposed during the revolution of 1979, 1980 or whatever. You know, Pahlavi, he's been, you know, campaigning pretty openly with a certain amount of Western support, you know, and I guess there are people who think he could actually take over. I mean, I'm reminded a little of, what was his name? The guy
Chalabi,
he was going to take over Iraq, and it turned out the Iraqi people had never heard of him.
That is the Shah's problem as well. Now, of course, Iranians have heard of him, but he's been out of the country since 1979.
Uh-huh.
He's never held a job in the United States. He has no experience. Yes, he has this online presence and this following, but it's more than a sign of strength. That following is a sign of weakness because it indicates the lack of any real opposition inside Iran. And if we've seen one thing, if we've learned one thing from these Middle Eastern dictatorships over the last few decades, it's that if they're good at one thing, it's suppressing opposition members, mm-hmm. putting them to exile, killing them, jailing them, so that there can be no nationally recognized opposition people who have stature. And that's the case inside Iran. And that's what makes it so dangerous. And when we saw Syria, for example, when the uprising, Arab Spring uprising 2011 started, there were 1,500 militias that sprung up by end of 2012, beginning of 2013. That's what the CIA was estimating. None of them had any national stature. Then you got ISIS and you got Al-Qaeda. And ultimately, Ahmed Ashara, the new president of Syria, was the head of Al-Qaeda, but it took him 14 years of maneuvering inside Syria, battles, that he rose to the top and became the sort of leader of the opposition. But he gained the national stature in doing that. But it took him 14 years and tons of bloodshed. And now he's president with tons of revolutionary legitimacy. But for Iran to arrive at that point, it's you could see all the dangers of Iran falling apart, because the fact there is this Shah and that we're talking about him, the son of the Shah, who hasn't set foot since he was a kid in Iran, is a bad sign.
Yeah. So do you think the most likely outcome in the wake of regime collapse is civil war?
You know, I do, but I'm not an Iran expert. Many of my Persian Iranian friends poo-poo this notion when I bring it up to them and say, no, the Azeris, you know, the millions of Azeris in the north, the 7-8 million Kurds, maybe it's more than that, 9 million Kurds, the Baluch, the Arabs, they're all Iranians, right? That's what the Persian Iranians, and Iran is only slightly more than 50% Persian, ethnic Persians. Mm-hmm. So it has some deep problems. And we've seen, you know, all my Syrian friends before 2011 swore mm-hmm. to me, I would always say, do you really want revolution? You're going to be like Iraq. It's going to fall apart. It's in emulous factions, and people are going to start killing each other. It's too scary to contemplate. And they would say, no, Josh, you don't understand. We are not like Iraq. We are, you know, we're a bourgeois nation and the urban elites are blah, 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 blah. It was not true. So I distrust my Iranian friends who say we're a nation, mm-hmm. and we're going to stick together. And we just saw last week, to underline this anxiety, that there were big demonstrations on some university campuses in Iran against the Islamic Republic authorities. But then counter demonstrations and students came out and clashed with them who are pro-regime. And, you know, it's easy to try to dismiss those students as just rent an opposition type thing or rent loyalists. But I think these countries are deeply divided. And that holds many dangers, especially if there's no leadership, responsible leaderships that can that have enough authority to restrain the passions and chaos that could break out easily.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, and these things are so unpredictable. You know, it's just a Pandora's box. It is just kind of shocking to me that Trump is being so cavalier about this, and that knowing Trump, what finally happens may depend on how he feels one morning when he wakes up, you know. What is your sense for that? I mean, how coherent a decision-making mechanism is there in the White House?
You know, that's the million-dollar question that everybody is asking themselves, right? I mean, I think, and many people are feeling that there really isn't a lot of, there's not a lot of pushback within the administration, that Trump has surrounded himself with yes men, and we're getting this sort of the same conundrum that we always accuse dictatorships of having, of not getting good criticism up at the top. Now, Trump's pretty, you know, he's pretty cagey. I don't want to underestimate Trump. So many people have underestimated Trump in the past. He may, you know, he may find a way to dodge this, but he got himself, he's wound himself up. You know, at first I thought he was just bluffing, but now he's put so many assets in the region, and he's told the Iranian people that we're going to be there to protect you. And I think he has that desire to actually fulfill those promises. So that's dangerous. And obviously I think that when he made that promise and said, we're going to come and help you, he saw the demonstrations as the boots on the ground. So America didn't have to have boots on the ground, because the Iranian people would be the boots on the ground. But then the regime managed to cow them through this real use of violence, and put them back in that fear. And now there aren't boots on the ground, or maybe not. So what do you do if you're United States? You can drop a lot of bombs and do a lot of destruction. But if you don't topple the regime at this point and you allow it to reconsolidate, you're going to be in the same dilemma. You're going to get sucked into that. There's going to be so much pressure to finish the job. You're going to look like a loser unless you finish the job. And that's why many critics of the first 12-day war were saying, don't do the 12-day war, because you can't walk away from it. Once you do that and you've half weakened the regime, there's going to be tremendous pressure on you within your own party, from Israel, from others in the neighborhood, saying, go and finish the job. And that's where we find ourselves. And Trump has fallen into that trap, if you will. And now he's feeling this pressure that he's got to do something or he's going to look weak.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, Josh, as you know, this podcast is divided into two parts. There's a pretty lengthy public part, and after that we go into overtime, available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in the show notes and so on.
One thing I think we should talk about a little bit before we go,
okay,
Bob, is the new the new security architecture that's being built in the Middle East now that this axis of resistance has collapsed, or the Shiite crescent, as it was sometimes called, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Hezbollah, that provided that security architecture and a balance of power between Israel and Iran, and restrained Israel from attacking Iran's nuclear facilities in the past because Israel was frightened that Hezbollah rockets would come over, and it made Israel hesitate. But as soon as they managed to destroy Hezbollah, all those bets were off, and Israel found a way to attack Iran and pound their nuclear facilities and get America to jump in, because America saw, you know, Iran's a paper tiger. We can take it down. And that's led to this, you know, this stampede to take down the Islamic Republic. But a new security architecture is beginning to emerge. We're only seeing the first signs of it, and that is Turkey and Saudi Arabia, with Syria in between, looking for Syrian stability and a strong figure in Ahmed Shara to try to help him build up, to create, if you will, a Sunni axis. Instead of a Shiite crescent that goes horizontally, you've got Sunni states that are trying to bring stability, if you will, stability for themselves in the region, and to restrain Israel to a certain degree, to keep Israel from bombing Syria, keep Israel from, you know, recognizing Somaliland, keep Israel from attacking Iran, because if there is chaos in Iran, that's going to really hurt Saudi Arabia and Turkey, who are both neighbors, who are both going to get hundreds of thousands of refugees coming into their land. It's going to destabilize all their plans for the future. MBS's, plan of 2030 depends on building the economy, tourism, investment, AI, technology, all these things that require stability and require proving to the world that the Middle East is a viable economic corridor. And a chaos in Iran is going to put all that in flames. And so I think they're trying to, you know, they're trying to come up with an alternative. And that's something that's new. The UAE is very skeptical of this. And we're seeing a real struggle, a real competition between Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And the UAE is siding with Israel. And the UAE has been very active in Sudan. And there have been a sort of contretemps there with Saudi Arabia in Sudan, in Somalia. All these are indicators that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are stepping up and trying to form a new security architecture. And that's, you know, in some ways it's good for the United States, because these are all friends. You know, America is in a very unique position because its enemies have really been taken down. Russia's not a factor in the Middle East, not a big factor. Iran is, you know, hanging by a thread. And here are its allies: Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Ahmed Shara, who Washington has embraced, trying to form a new security architecture. And America should be embracing that. This Iran action could disturb all that.
So the idea is that, in a certain sense, this array of nations, Saudi, Turkey, and so on, provides a kind of counterforce to Israel, and in that sense could help keep Iran safe from Israeli attacks. But it's a much less inflammatory counterforce than the Axis of Resistance was, because that depended on proxies that had deep, deep grievances against Israel. And in the case of Hamas, I mean, we're under de facto occupation and so on. And Hezbollah, of course, that whole tension started with Israel's invasion of Iran. And so this functionally could have something in common with the Axis of Resistance. In other words, it could be something that keeps Israel from attacking everybody, but is in principle much more benign. And right, I mean, but
yes,
because
I think you're right. I think that's an important point, which is Saudi Arabia is a friendly country to Israel. Now, there are certain people in Israel, and there have been numerous articles, most recently in Jerusalem Post and others, saying Saudi Arabia is going back to anti-Semitism and spewing this anti-Israel line, and it's becoming an enemy. And it doesn't have to be an enemy. Saudi Arabia wants to be a friend with Israel. Saudi Arabia has deep economic connections to Israel today and has a security interest because it doesn't want Iran to be strong, but it doesn't want Iran in chaos. You know, it likes Iran just where it is now, which is weak but stable. Mm-hmm. And Turkey is more of an enemy to Israel. I suppose, you know, Erdogan and Netanyahu have been spitting at each other for some time now, but Turkey is still trading with Israel. There's big trade.
Yeah.
Oil,
yeah.
Azerbaijan's oil all comes through Turkey. There are many other things that Turkey trades with Israel. So connections haven't been broken. Yes, there's this rhetorical enmity because Erdogan is an Islamist and he's deeply disturbed by what's happening in Gaza, but he's not an enemy of Israel in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
So it makes sense for the United States to help Turkey and Saudi Arabia establish some sort of new balance in the region to counterbalance Israel. You know, mm-hmm. I think there's a useful anecdote here in what Kissinger, after the 73 war, when Israel had re-expanded over the Golan, taken more Golan Heights, Sinai, it had expanded in many different directions. And Kissinger was trying to counter this expansion and arguing with Golda Meir. And he said to Golda Meir, if you want absolute security, we understand that, but a nation that has absolute security means that its neighbors are going to have absolute insecurity. Mm-hmm. And this is not going to be stable because they're going to constantly be trying to arm, bandwagon with others, make alliances. It's highly unstable. And as a realist who had written about the concert of Europe and so forth, he was all about the balance of power. And he understood that there needed to be some kind of balance of power in order to restrain the worst elements in all of the different countries. And this is an opportunity mm-hmm. for the United States to create a virtuous balance of power in the region that would help it stabilize, help these economies come forward, and making the Middle East a much more stable place than it's been for the last many decades.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's do go into overtime, but I want to sustain this train of thought because it's really interesting and it highlights how dumb it would be to start a war with Iran right now, in my view. But let's do. Thanks to everybody who followed us this far. Hope you'll join us. And the link is in the show notes if you're not already a paid subscriber. And I encourage you to follow Josh's work wherever you can find it. Are you still doing a little blogging? I mean, you write, you show
you know,
up.
I haven't been writing on my blog on Syria so much, but I do write long threads, and I'm constantly commentating on X,
yeah.
on Twitter. And then I do many podcasts like this one. I just did a few long podcasts with this Australian, Tom Switzer, who is very, very good, and others. So my commentary is constantly out there. I write for Foreign Affairs from time to time. So do follow.
Yeah, follow him on Twitter.